Hello and welcome to this Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the Royal College of GPs. My name is Sally Higginbottom and today I'm interviewing Dr. Anne Lashford, a GP in Wiltshire and one of the Vice Presidents of the Faculty of Sexual and Reproductive Healthcare. Hello, Anne.
Hello.
So the module we're discussing today is based on the 2018 NICE guidance on heavy menstrual bleeding. This is a great topic for primary care. It's such a common problem. Can you give us a bit of background on menorrhagia?
Well, in the past, people tended to try and quantify the amount of blood loss that women were having. But nowadays, the recommendation is really to look upon the effect that periods are having upon women's whole quality of life and their well-being.
So we've given up on any ideas of trying to quantify blood loss with pictures of pads and guessing how much blood is on them kind of ideas. Is that right?
Yes, very much so. If a woman defines that her periods are troublesome to her, interfering with her lifestyle, then we should be trying to find ways to improve things so that she has a much better quality of life.
And so what causes menorrhagia? How do we see this in pathological terms?
Well, we often don't find an underlying cause for it. There obviously are certain conditions which will lead to heavy periods, things that tend to make the area of the uterine cavity bigger, such as fibroids. So you've got a larger area from which your bleeding will tend to make your periods heavier. But for the vast majority of people, there is no underlying pathology.
Okay, and that then is quite a helpful piece of information when we start to think about investigations, which we'll come to in a minute. But who tends to get problems with their periods? I quite often see women at either end of their reproductive span with problems. Is that your experience?
Yes, certainly periods tend to get heavier with age. So women in their late 30s and 40s often will be getting increasingly heavy periods. I suspect probably because their uteruses have got a little larger. But some young girls will get quite troublesome periods, although often pain is a particular feature with them. But they may have the first few cycles maybe quite dysfunctional, probably because they're not ovulating during them and they can have some heavy bleeding. But I find often in the younger age, it's pain more than heaviness that's the major problem. With the older women, it's heaviness rather than pain.
So thinking about where we start with testing, the first line is often blood testing. And we've traditionally often tested things like thyroid function and a sort of hormone profile looking at estradiol or FSH levels in patients with menorrhagia. Is that useful?
No, not at all, really. I mean, there is no evidence to suggest that we should be checking thyroid function unless there are some other symptoms that make us think that the patient has thyroid disease. So if she has got no other symptoms, you know, tiredness, weight gain, the like, then don't check her thyroid function routinely. And there's no evidence that doing hormone levels is of any great use. They are very difficult tests to interpret. You need to know exactly which day of the cycle you're taking them on. And the range is huge, and it's not going to give you any useful information. The one blood test that is useful and which should be done on every woman who's complaining of heavy periods is a full blood count to see if she's anemic.
Yes, I think we've all had experiences as a sort of Friday night duty doctor of the phone call that tells you that this woman you saw yesterday with menorrhagia actually has a hemoglobin of 5. So we mustn't ever forget to check those. If pathology is relatively unusual, who would you examine? Do you examine all women who come with menorrhagia or a selected group?
It isn't necessary to examine all, but you need to take a careful history because you're looking for additional symptoms such as an erratic cycle, pelvic pain, or if they're getting pressure symptoms. And I'm always a bit more concerned if this is a new symptom of heavy menstrual bleeding. You know, they've had no trouble with their periods up until about a year ago, and now they're getting heavier and heavier and heavier. So those women should be examined to exclude other causes.
So you examine selectively, and if you are examining, what would that entail?
Well, start with an abdominal examination. If you can feel a bulky uterus there, that certainly is going to need further investigation. But they should have a proper bimanual examination to check out their pelvis, see if there's any tenderness.
And a speculum to have a look at the cervix?
That's not necessarily going to give you a lot of information other than possibly to see a polyp.
That's helpful. But if they're not having irregular bleeding, then that's an unlikely cause.
No. I mean, if they're... were any complaints of postcoital bleeding, they certainly need a speculum.
Okay, that's fine. And similarly, we often routinely request an ultrasound scan. Would that be your plan or would you be more selective?
I think you need to think about what the likely causes are going to be, and are you likely to pick something up on a scan? So if a patient's got a large uterus, a tender uterus, or they're getting pressure symptoms or pelvic pain, then you would want to do a scan because you may be looking for structural problems there, such as fibroids. However, if what she's presented with is heavy bleeding, but rather erratic bleeding with intermenstrual bleeding, that's a bit more suggestive of uterine cavity pathology, such as polyps. And for those women, outpatient hysteroscopy is now the recommended first-line investigation. We are now discouraged from doing blind papels. Biopsies should only be taken when you're doing a hysteroscope.
So those women would need referring. Are there any other women who would need referring for sort of red flags? Is there anything else we've mentioned? Cervical pathology, potentially? Anything else we should look for?
Well, cancer is a very rare cause of heavy menstrual bleeding, but there is a higher risk in women who've got intermenstrual bleeding or erratic bleeding, particularly those with other risk factors for endometrial pathology, such as women taking tamoxifen, those who are obese, and those who have polycystic ovary syndrome, particularly if aged over 40. And I'd have a very low threshold for further investigating those women.
One of the reasons I really enjoy working in women's health is there's such a lot of scope for patient involvement in decision making. It's particularly true in menorrhagia, and NICE have written quite extensively about this. How are they suggesting we engage patients in our decision making?
Women need to be informed of all the possible treatment options that are open to them and to have a full and frank discussion about the risks and benefits. Particularly among those things, we need to discuss the potential effects upon fertility, because that's relevant to many of the treatments that we're going to be giving.
Absolutely. And so what are the first line options for treatment?
Well, as I said, this will depend very much upon whether your patient is currently trying to conceive. If she's not, then very effective hormonal treatments are available, many of which also offer reliable contraception. So the first line treatment option for women with no identified pathology or fibroids that are less than 3 centimetres is the levonorgestrel IUS. I'm sure most people are familiar with these. Mirena has a license for heavy menstrual bleeding for use for 5 years. And the newer, rather similar Levocert has now got a license for heavy menstrual bleeding as well, but only for 4 years. Many women will become amenorrheic with these devices. And I've found that they've completely transformed the life of some women who've had significant heavy menstrual bleeding. They always regret that they didn't do it many decades before.
Yeah, and they're the big reason why we've got such a reduction in hysterectomy rates now as well, isn't it? Because we've got such an effective
completely.
Treatment.
There are other options, though, because some women just don't fancy having an intrauterine manipulation. The combined pill is fairly effective at reducing menstrual blood flow, but the only available combined hormonal contraceptive in the UK that has a license for the treatment of heavy menstrual bleeding is Clara. It's supposed to reduce the flow by around about 70%. We can also use Depo-Provera because, in my experience, most women will become amenorrheic after 2 or 3 injections, although it doesn't always happen immediately. And I think the one that is often forgotten is the dasogestrel progesterone-only pill, which is a really useful option if contraception is also needed. It's an extremely safe preparation, and a significant number of women will become amenorrheic on it. It's often worth a try because if women are going to become amenorrheic on it, they usually do it fairly quickly. So within a month or two, you'll know if it's going to work.
And it's very well tolerated. There are very few contraindications to the dasogestrel pills.
Yeah, it may not work. They may have erratic bleeding. They may continue to have a normal cycle, although it'll often be a little bit lighter. But as I say, in my experience, probably up to 50% of women seem to be amenorrheic on it, which is great.
Yeah.
The other thing just to think about are some of the newer intrauterine systems, JDES and Kylena, which do not have a license for use for heavy menstrual bleeding. But both of these will make periods lighter, although amenorrhea is unlikely. They've got a very, very low hormone content, so I find that they are sometimes acceptable options for women who basically don't like taking hormones.
Yes, and because the hormone's locally released under a substantially lower dose than a Mirena.
Yes, the amount entering the bloodstream is minimal.
Good options to have. The problem with all of those options for some women is that they're all contraceptive. What do we do for the woman who is trying to conceive but is having intolerable periods?
Well, we have got a couple of options which have been around for a very long time, actually. Tranexamic acid will reduce the menstrual flow by about 50%. We've been using it in gynae for a very long time, and it undoubtedly is effective, as are non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Traditionally, people have used mefenamic acid, but I'm not sure there's any evidence to say it's any better than ordinary ibuprofen. They have the advantages that you only have to take them at the time you have the heavy menstrual bleeding, so you're only taking treatment for a few days each month, so there's no worries if people are trying to conceive. And actually, you can take both tranexamic acid and an anti-inflammatory at the same time.
Excellent, because I think traditionally we used to do one and then the other, but there's no need to do that. We can give them both together.
No, tranexamic acid will reduce the flow by about 50%, non-steroidals probably by about a third. But remember, non-steroidals also are pain-relieving drugs, yeah, and are effective at relieving uterine pain. So if pain is the predominant thing, I would certainly be wanting people to try non-steroidals, as long as they've got no medical contraindications to taking them.
Nice talk about using cyclical norethisterone from day 5 to 26, but Provera is often suggested by gynaecology. Do you have a choice between those two?
We've used norethisterone a lot, and I think people are very familiar with it, but it does have some disadvantages. It certainly gives a lot of progestogenic side effects, and also it is partly metabolized to estrogen, so you should be very wary of using it in women who you might have concern if you were going to be putting them on the combined pill because of particularly VTE risk. Provera doesn't have that increased VTE risk. Both of them, incidentally, are licensed for treatment of heavy menstrual bleeding, but only as short cycle treatment for 7 to 10 days, which was the old regime that used to be used, which really has been shown to be ineffective. So the current recommendation of long cycle day 5 to 26 progestogens actually isn't licensed for either of them.
Okay, but it's an acceptable established treatment.
Yes, it is. I think we probably have better options like Mirena, but I find progestogens are sometimes quite useful when women have had heavy bleeding for quite a long time. They are completely fed up of it, and what they just need is it turning off for a month.
Yeah, perhaps while you're waiting for investigation or definitive treatment.
Yes.
And are these mostly options for women with small or no fibroids? Women with fibroids greater than 3 centimetres require some sort of surgical intervention, according to NICE. Is that right?
Yes, they're going to need referral for gynae for consideration of further treatment. Obviously, the options will vary according to whether women wish to retain their fertility or not. Those who do, myomectomy or embolisation of the fibroids are options. And for those whose families are complete, those are also options, but there is also the possibility of hysterectomy.
The definitive treatment, but with substantial morbidity associated.
Yes, and it must be remembered that women who have hysterectomy, even if the ovaries are left behind, are at risk of premature ovarian failure. In the last few years, there have been medical treatments for fibroids in the form of a drug called Esmia, but this was withdrawn earlier this year, and the European Medicines Agency is currently reviewing its safety and by no means any certainty that it'll come back on the market in the future.
So it's really a surgical intervention once you've got larger fibroids.
Yes.
Thanks, Anne. What were the key learning points in this module, do you think?
Well, I think the main message is that the majority of women with heavy menstrual bleeding will not have underlying pathology and can be treated in primary care with minimal investigation, just a haemoglobin. Also, if a woman says that her periods are heavy and interfering with her quality of life, that is all that is required for her to be offered treatment.
That's really helpful. And it's quite nice to be told to stop doing some things rather than that there are more and more tests we need to do. And in terms of resources for individuals or for practices, what's available at the moment?
Well, the Royal College of GPs very recently has released a very useful menstrual wellbeing toolkit, which covers not only heavy menstrual bleeding, but other period problems as well. On the RCGP website, there is a thing called the Women's Health CPD Library, which has collected together a whole load of articles relevant to women's health, which have all been approved by the RCGP, the RCOG and the FSRH. And from a patient perspective, there is some really useful information on period troubles on the NHS Choices website with a nice little calculator that they can work out if their periods are heavy. This is quite important because we estimate about 1 in 5 women actually suffer from heavy menstrual bleeding, but actually only about 1 in 20 consult their doctor, because many women just dismiss this as being normal, you know, and in the past, terms like the curse probably haven't helped that. So we need to make women more aware of the fact that they don't need to suffer in silence.
That's really helpful. And was there anything that surprised you in the module?
Well, the one thing that I think surprised me and many gynaecological departments around the country was the recommendation that outpatient hysteroscopy should be the first line investigation if uterine cavity pathology was suspected, as they really currently haven't got the capacity in most gynae departments to do this, and are continuing often to do papels.
So that may be something that NICE is aspiring to rather than a current offer in many areas.
I think many areas cannot currently provide the necessary number of hysteroscopy slots.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you for your time, Anne, and thank you for listening to this podcast from the RCGP.